So today's fun topic is going to be mostly quantum non-locality. So I'm going to do a bit about Bell's theorem. I know you've seen a proof of Bell's theorem before, so I'm not going to belabor it too much. But I want to talk about that as a kind of setup for the Kolbeck-Renner theorem, which probably you won't have seen before. So let's start. So previously we've been talking about ontological models for prepare and measure experiments just on a single system. So now what we're going to do is set up the framework, same kind of framework for the Bell inequality type of setup, right? So there's some preparation procedure that happens, and then at space-like separation, these are the backward light cones here, Alice makes a choice of measurement, gets an outcome. Bob makes a choice of measurement and gets an outcome. That's the basic setup. So therefore, our operational predictions are going to be of this sort of form. We'll predict the measurement outcomes given the choice of measurements and the preparation procedure. And as we were doing before, we assume that there might be some additional parameters around lambda. And then we will get this general decomposition, which just comes from the definition of conditional probabilities. There's no assumption in here yet, just that lambda is possibly correlated with the operational degrees of freedom. Now, everyone in this framework imposes the measurement independence assumption as we did before, which basically says that lambda doesn't depend on the choice of measurements here. So we kind of want to think of lambda as the properties of the system, which are controlled by the preparation, and that the measurement choices are free and independent of that. Okay, so that will give you a decomposition like this, where we don't have the x and y here. Remember, in the ontological models framework, we also imposed an additional assumption, which was lambda mediation, which says that all of the correlation between preparation and measurement is mediated by lambda. In the context of Bell's theorem, people don't normally make that assumption. You don't have to make that assumption. You can, but it doesn't make a big difference. But in any case, we're usually thinking of, not always, but we're usually thinking of a scenario where the preparation procedure is fixed. We just prepare a single entangled state. And so then when that's the case, we don't need to keep this dependence on P anyway. And so we write things like this in general. Okay, so that's the basic framework. So now I want to talk about a bit of a controversy to do with Bell's theorem. So, I mean, this has been going on for years, but a couple of years ago in 2014, it was the 50th anniversary of Bell's theorem. And so there were a lot of conferences about it. And so the fact that different physicists think about Bell's theorem in different ways became very apparent, and these debates blew up in the literature. So broadly speaking, there are sort of two ways that people think about Bell's theorem. It's the same mathematics, but conceptually they think of the assumptions as being different. And the best analysis of this that I personally think the best analysis of this is by Howard Wiseman. So he broadly categorizes two approaches to Bell's theorem, which he calls the operationalist and realist approaches. I put them in scare quotes because there's nothing really operational about this derivation. It's just that people who call themselves operationalists tend to like this approach, and people who call themselves realists tend to like this approach. Okay, so the point is that although they're mathematically equivalent, the operationalists and the realists make different assumptions, and therefore their conclusion about which assumption must be given up is different. Okay, so I'm going to explain this in more detail, but the operationalist approach says that what we learn from Bell's theorem is just that nature is non-deterministic. Or this is a quote from Asher Peres, "Unperformed measurements have no results." Right, so that was his take on Bell's theorem, not non-locality in particular. The realist approach has this assumption, and their conclusion is just that nature is non-local, right? We have shown, by showing that the Bell correlations exist, that there's non-locality in nature, period, that's it. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go through this approach first in detail. It's kind of the easier one to do anyway. And then I'll say a few things about this one. Okay, so what does an operationalist mean by locality? For an operationalist, locality, you know, in the sense of relativity, means that there should be no superluminal signaling. So the only things that an operationalist is going to admit as a locality assumption is something which has to do with superluminal signals. Okay, so we all agree that at the operational level, if you measure part of an entangled state, you can't send a signal. Okay, so this is Bob's marginal probability depends only on his measurement setting and not Alice's, right? So he can't detect anything about Alice's measurement setting if he just looks at his measurement outcome. Okay, so this is why it's not quite operationalist, but here's the idea. So suppose that when we condition on lambda, this is no longer true, okay? What that means is that if Bob was somehow able to not only observe his measurement outcomes, but could also have access to the state of reality, if he could see the state of reality directly, then Alice could send him a superluminal message, okay? Because he would just detect that this thing here depends on X, so depending on Alice's choice of X, he'll get different probabilities, that would be superluminal signaling. So therefore, even though we can't actually detect such a signal, there's a sense in which at the level of the underlying theory, nature really is sending superluminal signals. It's just for some reason we can't see them. Okay, so if you don't want those kind of superluminal signals, then you make this assumption here, which is that in fact, even when you condition on lambda, there's no dependence on the measurement setting on the other side in the statistics you see, right? So that's the assumption that the operationalist approach admits as the locality assumption. This on its own isn't enough to prove Bell's theorem. So usually they say there's an additional assumption in Bell's theorem. They'll say, the usual assumption that they say is that in addition, we demand that the theory is deterministic, right? So if you demand that the theory is deterministic, all of the probabilities are either 0 or 1 when you condition on lambda, then that gives you a pair of assumptions you can prove Bell's theorem. And of course, operationalists then say, well, this is locality, we want to keep it, so it's this one that goes. Nature's non-deterministic. So I just want to quickly go through how you prove Bell's theorem in that particular context from those assumptions. So by outcome determinism, each lambda is just going to specify two functions, right? So given both the input settings, that must determine what Alice's measurement outcome is. Given both the input settings, that determines what Bob's outcome is, okay? Then by parameter independence, this can't actually depend on Y, only depends on X. This one can't depend on X, only depends on Y. So as far as the predictions of the theory are concerned, when you specify lambda, that's equivalent to just specifying what A will be for each possible value of X. And independently of that, you specify what B will be for each of Bob's inputs Y. So in order to calculate the predictions of the theory, all you have to do is specify 4 numbers. What will A be when X is 0? What will A be when X is 1? What will B be when Y is 0? What will B be when Y is 1? And I'm going to assume that A and B take values plus or minus 1. Okay. So then here's how you prove CHSH inequality. You may not have seen it in exactly this way. This is like the way that I like to do it. So let's draw a diagram like this. So the nodes of this diagram represent those 4 numbers that we have to specify. And when I connect 2 things with a solid line, that means I would like them to be equal. Okay, so I'd like the value of a when x equals 0 to be the same as the value of b when y equals 0, for instance. And the dotted line means that I want them to be different. Okay. So now it's easy to see that on any assignment of plus and minus 1 to these four nodes, at least one link can't be satisfied. So let's do an example. Let's suppose we set this one here to plus 1. Then this one here has to be plus 1. This one here has to be plus 1. This one here has to be plus 1. And then we get a link that we can't satisfy. They should be different. Okay. So it's fairly easy to see that however you go about doing that, you get at most 3 out of the 4 links correct. You can also show that any assignment has to have at least one of the links correct, right? So let's try to make as many of these links incorrect as possible. Okay, so this is going to be plus 1, let's say. Then to not satisfy this, we'd have to have minus 1. Then to not satisfy this, we'd have to have plus 1. Then here, we'd have to have minus 1. But then to not satisfy this, you'd want these to be the same, but they're different, right? So you can just go through, and it's very easy to see. This is an example of what's called a frustrated network. You can't satisfy all of the links, and also, at most, one of them is satisfied. So, therefore, conditioned on lambda, so these are the probabilities are going to, all the probabilities are going to be, probability of AB given X, Y, lambda is going to be 0 or 1 in this theory. You can only have, at most, 3 out of these 4 probabilities equal to 1, so there's an upper bounded by 3, and at least one of them has to be equal to 1, so lower bounded by 1. And here I'm doing shorthand notation to avoid putting x equals y equals there. So this is x equals 0, y equals 0, etc. Okay, so now if we average this with respect to lambda, so we've got to average over the probability of getting a particular lambda, well, the average can't be larger than any of the individual terms, and it can't be smaller than the smallest term, right? So when we average over lambda, these are now the operational predictions that we can observe. They have to be between 1 and 3. So I'm going to call this equation 1. So now we can do the same reasoning, but with the opposite frustrated network. So now I've changed it so that what was supposed to be equal here has to be non-equal and vice versa. And then you'll see that this network obeys the same kind of reasoning. At most, 3 of the links can be satisfied, and at least one of them has to be satisfied. So when I swap between equals and not equals, all I've done is taken this inequality and changed the equals to not equals, the not equals to equals. I'll get the same inequality there. So I can take this inequality and multiply it by minus 1. That will change the direction of the greater than or equal to signs, and I'll get this inequality. Okay, so now what we're going to do is look at the expectation value of the product of A and B. Okay, A and B each take values minus 1. So when the product, so when A is equal to B, this product's equal to plus 1. And when A is different to B, the product's equal to minus 1. So these expectation values are just the difference between the probability that A equals B and the probability that A is not equal to B. So if I take this inequality here and I add it to this inequality here, I'm just going to get each term becomes one of these expectation values, and I get the opposite sign on the last one because this was the equals term here has a minus sign and the not equals term has a plus sign. So those expectation values have to be between 2 and minus 2, and that is what's called the CHSH inequality. Okay, and then as you probably know, this gets violated in quantum mechanics. So if Alice and Bob share, for example, the singlet state, and if they measure Pauli observables, so spin observables or Pauli operator observables in an arbitrary direction, then you can show that in general, when they make that measurement, their expectation value is just minus the inner product of the directions that they measured it. And then if you choose these four observables, you can look at the inner products here and see that every single term in the inequality here is going to be 1 over root 2. So you'll get 4 times 1 over root 2, 2 times root 2, and that's larger than 2. Okay, so you can't satisfy this inequality for all quantum predictions. Okay, so that shows that the operationalist assumptions, one of the operationalist assumptions must be wrong. So either parameter independence or outcome determinism is wrong. Now let's have a look at the realist version. So the realist version is the assumptions are different. It's going to be the same mathematics ultimately. So realists adopt a different principle. So their principle of locality is not about signaling per se, but it's about the idea that if two things are correlated, then there has to be some cause of that. Okay, correlations need a causal explanation. So if you look at what do we usually say about probabilistic causes anyway, so there's this principle called Reichenbach's principle, which a lot of people accept about what a causal explanation is. It says that if two things A and B are correlated, then either it must be the case that A causes B, A is somehow the cause of B and B is its effect, or B causes A, or the third option is that there's a common cause for both A and B, and then we expect that if you condition on that common cause, then that will screen off the dependence between A and B. Okay, so those are the three possible options. Now, in a Bell experiment, the two measurements are space-like separated. So if they're correlated, and we believe in relativity, it can't be the case that either one and two are ruled out, right? They can't directly cause one another. So it must be that there's a common cause, and in the spirit of relativity, we'd say that should be in their joint past, that gives an explanation something like this. Okay, so here's basically how it goes. This is the setup of the Bell experiment. Okay, so in the realist approach, how will we think about lambda? We will think about lambda as a complete description of all the physical properties in some region of space-time that should screen off these two things from these two things. Okay, so what I mean by that is, technically speaking, we're not going to allow influences that travel backwards in time, right? So what we're going to look at is all past-directed time-like curves that go from one of these two things to one of those two things, right? So for example, any time-like curve from here to here has to go back here and then up here, right? So it has to pass through this region lambda at some point. Okay. So it doesn't have to be exactly the joint backwards light cone. It could be a larger region. It could be a slightly different region. We could take a region that sort of cuts like a line like this. The point is that it should be something that we have reason to believe should screen off these two things from these two things. Okay, so if that's the case, then the causal structure looks something like this, right? So this arrow means can be a direct cause of, okay? So there can't be an arrow directly from A to B, they're space-like separated, but lambda can affect both A and B. And we're assuming measurement independence, remember, so X and Y aren't directly correlated with lambda, but they also influence A and B, like that. So if you have a causal structure like that, then you would expect that it decomposes like this, okay? So basically, the direct causes of A are X and lambda, the direct causes of B are Y and lambda, and there shouldn't be any correlations other than that. So this is the condition that's called local causality, right? And so if you want to reprove Bell's theorem under this assumption, which is a slightly different proof from what I did, you're not assuming determinism, then working through that is one of the homework problems. And in a way, you've probably seen it before. Okay, so now let's talk about the connection between these assumptions. So in the operational approach, we assume this notion of parameter independence here. So it's basically the no signaling condition when you also know what the value of lambda is. If you add an additional assumption, which is called outcome independence, then you get local causality. So outcome independence just says that the probability of B, when you condition on absolutely everything else, doesn't depend on Alice's outcome. So the probability of Bob's outcome doesn't depend on Alice's outcome when you condition on X, Y, and lambda, and vice versa. When you take these two things together, then you get local causality, right? So you, in general, can write down the probability distribution like this. So this is just the usual law of, yeah.
Outcome independence is actually not true in quantum mechanics, right?
Subtle. It's subtle because it depends. So this is something that I've had very long arguments with different people on.
I mean, if I just prepare a Bell state and I measure like in up, down, there, and in up, down, there, then there is outcome dependence. If I get up here, I get down there.
Okay, so it also depends on, because remember, this whole thing is conditioned on lambda, right? So what is lambda in standard quantum mechanics, right? Some people will say, oh, it's the quantum state. Some people will say, if they're operationalists, oh, it's nothing, right? So, well, because if you're an operationalist, you really believe that correlations don't have to have a causal explanation at all, right? So anyway, so the point is, and it also depends on whether you include collapse of the wave function as part of your theory, because if I say that when I measure a system, there's a collapse over here, that's a change of lambda at that point. And remember, I said there are many different possible regions you could choose here. So depending on how you choose that, if I choose this region to include some part here where the collapse occurs, then there's a collapsed wave function in lambda as well. So it's most people will say that quantum mechanics satisfies parameter independence but violates outcome independence, as you say. But it's subtle because it depends exactly how you formulate what you mean by standard quantum mechanics. Anyway, so the point is that if I can write this decomposition, an arbitrary probability distribution like this, and then if I apply outcome independence to this term, I get this. And then if I apply parameter independence to both these terms, then I get this, right? So that's local causality. And you can obviously derive these two from local causality as well. So outcome determinism. So remember, the operationalist assumption was parameter independence plus determinism, outcome determinism. Now the outcome determinism assumption implies this outcome independence assumption here. Just sort of in words, the reason is if both A and B are just functions of X, Y, and lambda, then learning A doesn't tell you anything more about B than if you already knew X, Y, and lambda. It was already a function, right? So B was already a function of X, Y, and lambda, just a function of them with outcome determinism. So learning A can't help you to predict that more precisely. You already knew it exactly. Okay. So that's the connection between the two assumptions. So now, this is not exactly what operationalists and realists say. This is like my reconstruction of what they ought to say. So an operationalist will say, oh, you know, you realists, you're assuming outcome independence, right? This has got nothing to do with superluminal signaling, and so therefore isn't a locality assumption. It's like some weird additional extra thing, right? You don't have control of A is random outcome. So, you know, this being violated has nothing to do with superluminal signaling. Only this is to do with superluminal signaling. Right? I mean, where does this outcome indeterminism, outcome independence come from? Well, really, you know, the reason why you think that is because, you know, you're implicitly thinking it's determinism. Like, determinism is the only real reason why you would think that assumption holds. So that's what should be given up, and quantum mechanics is local, everything's fine. The realist would say, no, we're not assuming outcome indeterminism. What we're doing is we're just assuming that correlations have to have a causal explanation in the Reichenbach's principle sense. And then outcome independence, it's like, it's just a consequence of that. It's not fundamental. Yes?
In order to even write down the outcome independence, you have to have a lambda, right? So what does it mean for...
Well, you could write it down. Lambda could be right. I mean, you certainly could write down this equation without lambdas. It would then be violated by the quantum predictions, right? Right, so they say, well, you know, for the realist, outcome independence is not some fundamental thing, neither is determinism, right? They would agree that determinism is an unjustified assumption. Why? That's nothing to do with there being a causal explanation. They're not assuming it. So the only assumption we're making is a locality assumption. Local causality itself is what we mean by locality, a locally causal explanation. So the conclusion is just that nature is non-local, because there wasn't any other assumption in there. So that's kind of the debate. Then an operationalist response for that would be, well, I don't believe that correlations need to have a causal explanation. The only kind of locality I care about is signaling. What's this causal explanation is rubbish. Okay, so my own take is I tend to side with the realists, right? I think that, well, at least if you are a realist, causal explanation is part of the spirit of realism. But, I mean, it's fairly clear that this debate is just completely unresolvable. It could go on forever. Both sides are making different assumptions, and so they're not going to agree. However, what we can say is that both operationalists and realists believe that locality requires parameter independence. They're agreed on that, at least. So what's the real question we should ask? We should ask, what can you prove if you just assume parameter independence? Because both realists and operationalists will have to accept the result of that. Okay. So that's what we're going to look at next. And that leads us to the Kolbeck-Rinner theorem. Now, I should make some comments of this, just in case you want to read the original papers on this. So Renato Renner is an extremely smart guy who about once every 4 years publishes, mostly works on quantum information, but once every 4 years or so, he publishes a result on quantum foundations, which usually turns out to be extremely important, at least according to me. However, he usually writes it in a way which, I don't know, probably not deliberately, but antagonizes lots of people in the quantum foundations community. He writes it in such a way that it sounds like his result rules out Bohmian mechanics and stuff like that. So their version of the Kolbeck-Rinner theorem you'll see in these papers says it has to do with a free will or free choice assumption, and then they conclude that things like that there's no can be no free will in theories like Bohmian mechanics. That's, of course, not a great way of saying it. So I am reinterpreting their theorem, same mathematics, as what I think it really means. So all I'm saying is that if you read these papers, you may find them a little bit different from what I'm about to present. So what I'm going to do first is look at the special case of their theorem when you deal with a maximally entangled state, because that we can fully prove in the lecture. So let's consider this maximally entangled state of 2 qubits, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. And what we're going to do is let the x and y parameters, the settings, vary over all possible orthonormal basis measurements that we could make on that state. Okay, so we're now going to have, in principle, an infinite number of measurement settings, not just 2 as we had in the Bell's setting. Then what they prove is that any model satisfying parameter independence must also just predict, when you just look at the marginal analysis side, so just look at Alice's marginal probabilities, whether or not you know lambda, it's just 50-50. Okay. So another way of saying this is like the quantum predictions for the maximally entangled state are that if I just make any orthonormal basis measurement on Alice's side, don't care about what Bob's doing, the quantum predictions in that case are 50-50 in all bases. Yeah. Do you have a question?
So what's lambda here exactly?
Lambda is the same as in any as it was before. It's like any additional variables that are correlated with the operational predictions.
So why is this 1/2 if you do know the ontic state?
Exactly, that's what's proved. What's proved is that if parameter independence holds, you actually can't make better predictions than quantum mechanics tells you. I mean, that this is the content of the theorem. This is difficult to prove, right? So actually, what happens, at least in this case of the maximally entangled state here, is that we're not looking at the correlations, but we're just looking at the subsystems. You can't have a theory which allows you to make any more fine-grained quantum predictions than quantum mechanics could. Okay, so here we're only making assumptions that everybody would agree with. So what would be the response? So an operationalist might say, see, so previously they said a local model has to be non-deterministic. Now they've got something more powerful. Not only doesn't it have to be non-deterministic, it has to make the exact same predictions of quantum mechanics, even if you condition on lambda. Right, at least in this case, and we'll show a more general result later. So they'll say, well, it might as well just be quantum mechanics. Why bother introducing any additional variables at all? A realist response to this might be, well, since the whole point of introducing ontic states is that you think it's going to give you something different than quantum mechanics. Right, you might want, for example, a deterministic theory, or even if you don't, you expect that lambda is going to give you some more information than if you didn't know it, right? Otherwise, it's fairly useless. So what the realist will say is, okay, well now, instead of just saying that nature is non-local, we'll say, actually, specifically, we expect that it's going to violate parameter independence. And in fact, things like Bohmian mechanics do violate parameter independence. I have to say that no realists or operationalists that I know of who write papers about these things have ever said these things, mostly because they ignore the Kolbeck-Renner theorem, but this is what they should say. Okay, so what I'm going to do for the rest of the lecture is prove this. It's a little bit more challenging, quite a bit more challenging than Bell's theorem. And then at the end, I'll give a more general statement of the theorem. Okay, so let's start by considering a case where Alice and Bob can each choose n orthonormal basis measurements. And for convenience, I'm going to label Alice's choice of measurements by even integers and Bob's choice of measurements by odd integers. You'll see why we'll do that in a minute. But so there are n possible even integers here and n possible odd integers there. Okay, so now I'm going to define the following set of states. Which is like this. So they come in orthogonal pairs. So k takes the value 0 or 1. And this top value just determines the size of this angle. Right? So you get angle increments of j over 2m. Right? And then when I add pi, I get the orthogonal state. Okay, so the key point is that for these states is that the bottom index here, the same top index specifies an orthogonal pair. So if I'm letting this top index here be x and vary over the even numbers and y vary over the odd numbers, then I'll get some sets of orthonormal bases for Alice's system and some sets for Bob's systems. So here's what it looks like on the Bloch sphere. We're just in a two-dimensional plane spanned by the 0 and the 0 plus 1 state. And what's happening is that, so here I'm just drawing the 0 of these pair of bases. So this one, the other orthogonal basis state is pointing in the opposite direction. So basically, these states are at equally spaced angles, and they alternate, right? So the 0, 1 basis is one of Alice's bases. then the next one is one of Bob's bases, then we have one of Alice's bases again, etc. So it just goes around like that. And then the last one is just the one just before you would get back to the start. This is the same basically set of states we used in the proof of the excess baggage theorem, Harder's excess baggage theorem, except for the fact that now they're alternating between an Alice basis and a Bob basis, like that. Okay. By the way, these measurements are called chained Bell measurements for slightly obscure reasons which have to do with their historical, where they first occurred. But let me not go into that. Okay, so now I'm going to consider a correlation measure. This is a little bit like the thing that we look at in Bell's theorem, except generalized to more measurements. Okay, so what I'm going to look at is the probability of correlation of exact equality when I make the x equals 0 measurement and the y 2n minus 1 measurement. So I'm looking for correlation between this measurement and this measurement here. And then for all other pairs of measurements where x and y differ by 1, I'm going to look at how anti-correlated they are. Okay, so this is basically the structure of the correlation measurement, right? So, and I apologize here because I flipped the interpretation of solid and dashed lines, right? So dashed solid line here means I want these two things to be different, and a dashed line means I want them to be the same. So this term here consists of all pairs where x and y differ by 1. So I want these two things to be correlated, I want these two things to be correlated all the way down, and then anti-correlated, yes, sorry. I want these all to be anti-correlated, and then I want the last one to be correlated. Okay, so qualitatively, I'm just going to explain to you qualitatively why we expect that when n equals large, when n is large, we expect this to be small. Why is that? Okay, so for large n, first of all, we need to note, and we discussed this, I don't know, back in the first or second lecture, I think, that if you have this maximally, where was it? This maximally entangled state here, and if you make measurements that are in the xz plane of the Bloch sphere, here we're in the xz plane of the Bloch sphere, when Alice and Bob measure in the same basis, they always get perfect correlations. They always get the same outcome, okay? Now, if we look at the case where this one, where x equals 0 and y is 2n minus 1, then for large n, these two states are going to be almost orthogonal, right? So this is Bob's 0 outcome, this is Alice's 0 outcome. So you expect that that's going to be almost all the time is going to be anti-correlated, right? So you expect that this term is going to be close to 0. And similarly, for all the other terms where these differ by 1, oops, so let's look at these two, for instance. These bases are going to be almost parallel, so you expect them to be correlated almost all the time. So therefore, you expect each of these terms to be close to 0 as well. Okay, so what do you do? Well, you have the tools, right? So you just plug in these measurement bases to this state, and then you can figure out, use quantum mechanics, figure out what the probabilities are, and then compute these things, right? It's just computable. You can just, it's a fairly easy calculation, it's just like a bit laborious. But what you find is that your intuition is correct. You find that this correlation measure is precisely given by this function. And the point is that this is clearly a function that goes to 0 as n tends to infinity. That's the important part. What you can do is do an approximation of the sine squared by Taylor expansion, etc., and show that it's, strictly speaking, goes down like 1 over n, or less than 1 over n. But the important point is that, as expected, in the limit of large n, this correlation measure goes to 0. That's the fact that we're going to use in the end about these measurements. Okay, so then we need one more technical tool before we can prove a theorem, which is the concept of the variational distance between two probability distributions. So suppose you have PA and QA, and their probability distributions over some finite variable A, the same variable. Then we define the variational distance between P and Q just by this function. So for each value of A, take difference between the probability that P and Q assigns to it, take the absolute value of that, sum over all, and take factor of half or, I don't have a lot of time to go into the details of where this comes from, but there's good reasons for giving that value a half. What that does is it makes sure that this varies between 0 and 1. So 1, you get 1 only if the two probability distributions are the same, and you'll get 0 if they have no overlap. Point is,
It's the other way around. If they're the same, it's 0.
If they're the same, it's 0. And if they have no overlap, it's 1. Yeah, you're right. I have included a few slides at the end, which I won't present in the lecture, but they'll be in the Dropbox when you look at the slides, proving some of the properties that we need for this. In particular, we need to know it's a metric, because we're going to use the triangle inequality later. And the other important property that we're going to use is this theorem here. So suppose you have a joint probability distribution, and it happens to be the case that the two marginals are equal to P and Q. Right, so here, A is just another copy of, A prime is just another copy of A, takes the same possible values. So if the two marginals are equal to P and Q, then you can prove that this distance is, for any such distribution, less than or equal to the probability that A is not equal to A prime. So I will include the proof of that on the final slides that we probably won't have time to talk about. But you know, it's sort of just a technical tool we're using. It's not the key sort of conceptual part of the proof. Okay, so actually, since I'm doing quite well for time, we might actually get to that. Okay, so let's think again about our correlation measure, except this time I'm conditioning it on lambda. So I'm going to have the same probabilities as before, except now they're all conditioned on lambda. Okay, so I'm going to call this in lambda. This is now a function of lambda, and the average of this over lambda, if I average this over the probability of lambda, needs to give me the correlation measure that I had before. So what I'm going to do is first of all define a new variable. So A tilde is just going to be the opposite of A, right? So A tilde is the variable such that when A is 0, I set A tilde equals 1, and when A equals 1, I set A tilde equals 0. Actually, should I have made this? Oh no, everything's 0 and 1 here. Good. Okay, so that's just so that I can write the first term as these two probabilities being different instead of the same, right? Because from this result, I'm going to be able to write these things in terms of variational distances. That's the idea. Okay, so if I do that, I now have a bunch of terms. They're all in terms of not equals, and there's one term here, the first term, which has an A tilde instead of an A. Okay, so that's it. So now, what I can say using this result, right, so here I have things that are in terms of probabilities of not being equal, that's going to be greater than or equal to the corresponding variational distances. So it's going to be the variational distances of the marginals over A and B of this joint probability distribution. Okay, so for the first term, I've now just got probability of A given all of this stuff, probability B given all of this stuff, and then similarly for all of the other terms. So now I have a bunch of variational distances. Now I apply parameter independence. Parameter independence tells me that this thing here, this is Alice's measurement outcome, doesn't depend on Y. Okay? And here, the probability of B doesn't depend on X. And similarly for these terms. So this one isn't going to depend on Y. This one isn't going to depend on X. So those are going to drop out. So I'm just going to get this expression. I've just got rid of the dependence of Y here, the dependence on X here, and similarly for these terms. Okay, so that's where parameter independence gets used. Okay. Now we need to use another property, which is that the variational distance is a metric, and metrics satisfy the triangle inequality. So the distance between P and Q is less than or equal to the distance between P and R, and the distance between R and Q. Right, that's the standard property of a metric. Right? If I want to get from P to Q, it's quicker to go directly than it is to go via somewhere else. That's what that says. Now let's consider, I'm going to write out this correlation metric in a bit more detail. Just remember this was the structure of it, right? So we have, okay, this was the first term previously, but I'm starting here. So these are the terms that are in the sum. I've got this correlation metric. And then because the metric's symmetric, I can flip the order of B and A. And you see that this term is going to give me a distance between this guy and this guy. Then I've got a distance between this guy and this guy. Then I've got a distance between this guy and this guy, and so forth all the way down until we get down here. And then I've got a distance between this guy and the first one, except the first one's flipped. Right, so you can see that I can apply the triangle inequality multiple times because I can apply it first to these guys, eliminate this distribution, right? And basically, this whole thing is going to be greater than or equal to what I get by going through that whole thing and then just ending up with one final term, which is going to be the difference between this and itself, basically. Well, it's not quite this in itself, it's itself flipped, right? So we have at the start here the distribution over A, and then we have the distribution over A tilde, right? A tilde is just the flipped version of A. It's 0 when A is 1 and 1 when A is 0. Okay, so now when I average this correlation, So now when I average this correlation measure over lambda, it has to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. And we showed that that was In and it was bounded by something like 1 over N. So now if I take this equation and I take the limit as n tends to infinity, make these bases closer, more closely and closely spaced, then what that means is that, well, the limit of this is 0. The correlation measure is always positive. So when I integrate the limit of that thing over the lambda probabilities, I have to get 0. Okay. Now, everything here is positive functions, right? So on the support of this probability distribution, in order to get this, this function has to be 0, at least up to sets of measure 0. Everything's always up to sets of measure 0, which I'm not worrying too much about. Okay, so therefore, on that support, I lambda, which we showed was just the distance between this probability distribution over A and its flipped version, has to be 0, right? So this distance here has to be 0. That's what we've shown. Okay, but what is this distance? Well, because A is just the flipped version of A, this is the sum of the difference between the case where A equals 0 and A equals 1, and the second term is going to give me A equals 1 and A equals 0. Well, I've just got two times the same term, right? So this term just has to be 0. So this probability has to equal that probability, right? So they're both a half. And that's what we set out to prove, okay? Because half is the same as the quantum predictions in this case. So what I've done is, so the case x equals 0 corresponds to this basis, which is just the 0, 1 basis on the Bloch sphere. So I've proven that for the 0, 1 basis, the ontological model has to predict the same probabilities as quantum mechanics does. But by symmetry, I could have done this for any basis, right? Because I could have started the chained Bell construction from any two states, right? 0 and 1 were just labels for some states. So you could have done this for any basis, and so therefore, now if we allow ourselves to vary over all orthonormal bases, you will see that you have to get this result for every single basis. Okay, so that proves the theorem. Okay, so I mean, this is in some sense quite a restricted case, though, right? It doesn't prove that the same sort of thing has to be true for any state, right? So what you'd like is a theorem that holds for any state, right? You'd like to say, I have to get the quantum predictions, basically. So you don't quite get that. This is what you get. This is the full statement of the Kolbeck-Renner theorem, which is would take much, much longer to prove. But consider any state. Now, one fact that's true about entangled states, pure entangled states, is that you can always find an orthonormal basis for both systems such that the state can be written like this. This is called the Schmidt decomposition. It's if you've done quantum information, you might have seen the proof of this before, right? So that you can always write any entangled state, well, doesn't have to be entangled, but any bipartite pure state like this. Okay, so then what does the full Kolbeck-Renner theorem prove? It proves that you take any state, then you can find some other state, right? So we're going to take this state and bring in another state on two other systems. And then suppose we allow ourselves to do all local POVMs. So I have a joint POVM on the AA prime system, a joint POVM on the BB prime system. So I'm allowing myself to do all possible measurements on this bipartite system composed of this state and this state. And suppose you have a parameter independent model for that, then if you measure in this thing in the Schmidt basis, then you get the same result. Okay. So that's the most general thing, right? So for these entangled states, so bear in mind that when we prove things about ontological models, we're often in a very restricted setting. But if you're wanting to prove something, so if your model really reproduces quantum mechanics, it's got to reproduce all of quantum mechanics, right? So even if you add additional systems, you still want your model to work. If you start doing dynamics, you still want your model to work, right? So the fact that we need an extra state here doesn't really matter because you still need to reproduce the predictions when you include extra states. You need the reasoning involved with this, but you do end up getting a result which applies to just a measurement on the system A alone. Okay, but this isn't everything. So it's not like we haven't quite said that parameter-independent ontological models have to agree exactly with the predictions of quantum mechanics because it only works for this particular basis. Yeah.
Is this extra state completely arbitrary or in the proof?
No, in the proof it's so technically what they use, I don't know if you know how much you know about this stuff, but they use a concept called embezzlement of entanglement. So this turns out to be an embezzling state. Technically, that's what you need to use. It doesn't have to be anything. But anyway, you'd expect an ontological model to reproduce the predictions of anything. So, conceptually, for the significance of the theorem, it doesn't matter. Just the fact that there exists a state you can do this with is enough already. Okay, but there's a way of thinking about this theorem. So remember that when we do a measurement, so suppose you have psi is equal to alpha 0, plus beta 1. And if we want to treat a measurement in the 0, 1 basis unitarily, then what we do is we tensor this with some ready state of the measurement device, then we do a unitary interaction, which gives you alpha 0 measurement device in state 0 plus beta 1 measurement device in state 1. So if you did implemented the measurement unitarily like that, you would get this form of the state, which is exactly in this kind of Schmidt form here. So, and then if you were to measure the measurement device, you would get the same probabilities as doing the measurement directly on the state. So if you believe that your ontological model should also allow you to treat measurements as an interaction between a system and a measurement device, like this. If you believe that this should be reproduced by your ontological model, sort of the Church of the Larger Hilbert space picture, then what you can say is that this must apply for measurements on just an individual system, right? Because I can convert an individual system into this correlated form by unitarily doing a measurement and then actually do the measurement on the measurement device. Okay, so if you believe that there should be that kind of Church of the Larger Hilbert space picture, then what you can really say is that this kind of thing has to apply for measurements on a single system, all orthonormal basis measurements on an individual system. And that would be a very strong result, because that would really be telling you that lambda is completely useless for predicting extra things. Okay, so I just had... so that's basically it. If anybody wants me to go through proofs of the properties of the variational distance, I can. But otherwise, we should stop here. Are there any questions? Yes.
What's the what connection do they make in the paper to the free will?
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this supersedes the free will theorem. Okay. In the free will theorem, again, you have to assume parameter independence and determinism. Right, so here you're assuming just parameter independence, and you get a stronger conclusion, which is not just that determinism can't be true, but specifically it must be the quantum predictions. So as far as I'm concerned, you can forget about the free will theorem, because this supersedes it. This is stronger. Any other questions? All right, I think we'll leave it there then.